Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Dan and Peter Haig, and we sure hope that you have all your arrangements made for the world's 50 best restaurants coming up.
Coming up in between Bilbao and San Sebastian in the Basque Country of Spain on the 17th, 18th, and 19th of June.
Yes, and it's one of the great gala spectaculars of the year.
And if you do get there, be sure to say hi.
Yes.
And because it's a big party.
Oh, it's a big party. Last year in Melbourne was fabulous.
I'm sure the Spaniards are going to try to outdo themselves. and why wouldn't they in the cradle of modern gastronomy?
Yeah, I'm sure we will have spectacular jamón.
Yeah, we can sell that one. We can sell that title. Anyway.
All right.
Back to earth.
Yeah.
Here we go with. A really wonderful lady of the culinary field, whose name is
Joan Nathan, is wonderful, and we've received some of the most spectacular books they're putting out now. I mean, they're grand. This one, as well as the one we did last week, represents 5 years of research, and of course, it's wonderful.
Why don't we just play the track?
Exactly. Well, I didn't realize how much I didn't know until I picked up my copy of King Solomon's Table by Joan Nathan. Joan, how long did it take for you to write this incredible book?
It took me about 5 years, actually. Yeah. But, you know, you have to realize that you have a life in between. So
yeah, right.
I like to take a long time with my books because I like to think about them, you know, think about recipes and what they mean and then put them into context of all of our lives.
Well, I mean, the introduction by Alice Waters says pretty much you're indefatigable about sourcing, tracking down these recipes and so forth. And I can see that. I mean, there's so much information, as I told you before we went on. It's dense with information. It's history. It's experience. It's fabulous recipes. But you have to get immersed in this to get the full benefit of the book.
Right.
It's beautiful
exactly.
as well.
Yeah, I tell everybody to read the introduction, and then they can understand what the book's all about.
Well, now you were saying something just before we came on the air about your Yemeni chicken soup.
That's Peter's favorite thing. He makes ours.
I love that recipe.
We're going to have to switch to this recipe.
It's taken over from my regular chicken soup, and it's a recipe that I learned many, many years ago. I was in Jerusalem, and I met a jewelry maker whose last name was Tzadok. Mm-hmm. And his father he must have been close to 100.
Oh, no.
And they invited me to come to a meal before the fast of Yom Kippur. Mm-hmm. And I went to their home. Everybody was sitting on the floor. And they had this soup, and people dipped their bread into it, and they had all kinds of different spice combinations. Tzug, which is green hot pepper.
Of course, I noted that. I want to make that, too.
Peppers came from, from the New World to the Old World. And then they had something called hilba, which is a lot of fenugreek, which is a very healthy herb, and then I forget what the Hawaii, which is a spice
that's
combination.
That's Peter's thing with the turmeric. And me too. I have turmeric almost every day.
And so there are all these new exotic spices, and it just changed the way, you know, just living in Jerusalem, by the way, changes the way that you look at food, and more so, I think, back when I was there, because I was working for the mayor of Jerusalem.
What did you do for him?
I was his foreign press attaché for Teddy Kollek, the longtime mayor of Jerusalem.
When was that?
70 to 72, when I was very young.
Well, we were in Australia at the time.
We understand you were only in grade school.
Right.
No, I think the first Yemeni chicken soup version we got was that guy who cooks Israeli in Philadelphia.
Solomonov.
Oh, Michael. Solomonov, right.
Solomonov, I think. So I co-opted fresh and dried fenugreek. I mean, not fenugreek.
Turmeric again.
Into my chicken soup, and it's pretty good.
But I bet it is.
But I'm going to make yours because I've never put potatoes in.
There's lots of stuff I never put in.
Potatoes is new world. You know, certainly the early recipes didn't have potatoes in them, right. Nor did they have tomatoes in them. But, you know, recipes, just as people, change throughout history.
Well, you know, this whole, I mean, as I said, I did not realize how little I knew about all this history until I picked up your book. I mean, here in this one page, it's called The Bagel's Journey from Ancient Egypt to Almost Everywhere. It's just amazing.
Now, here's a
point. Yeah, well, that's pretty, I think that's. Yeah, and you realize between trade routes and looking at different cultures, what foods they eat today, you learn about what they ate before. And, you know, even just going to the old city of Jerusalem, I saw how they ate something called a bagel, which was like a yeast floppy bagel. And you hung it on a stick. So I realized the bagels were used in Poland on sticks, in ancient Egypt. Even in the hieroglyphics, you saw these round rolls with a hole. And sometimes they were like kak, which is Syrian, which were they weren't boiled and baked. Those were just round and delicious. And crunchy. I love them. And then there were some, you know, that were boiled and baked, and that's when we got to Poland. Yeah, and then, in the Alps, you find boiled and baked, and you realized that probably the Alps was a place where people that were fleeing one country to another, whether it be from the Nazis, or from the Inquisition, or from wherever, people would hide in these alpine villages. And then all of a sudden you'd see unexpected foods, like a boiled and baked roll with a hole.
And then we thought that it was invented by Dunkin' Donuts.
Right.
shows you how much we know.
Such a long, long history. It's just...
Now, here's my question. What did the Queen of Sheba cook for King Solomon?
Oh, that's the question. I don't know, but I'll bet it was and it was spicy, except that when they didn't have hot peppers back then, so they used a lot of spices, mm-hmm. You know, the turmeric and hot... They didn't even have hot pepper until, like, 16th century. So it might have been a different... I think some people say that there's one pepper from Africa.
There could be, yeah.
But it certainly was spicy, that's for sure.
You have Frika in here. And I mean, the stories are all surrounded by all kinds of romantic ideas. You're not sure, though, if... What's true and what isn't, right?
Well, I mean, nobody can be 100% sure, especially with ancient history.
Right, but it's just, I just am overwhelmed with how long something has gone on with these traditions.
Well, Fricka is straight out of the Bible.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we loved the story about the fact that it was self-igniting after they stored the green wheat.
Right, exactly.
And then there was nothing else to eat,
you know what? You can go to the old city today of Jerusalem and you find these old women selling this fricka just the way they did in biblical times. And you know, what's so interesting is a lot of the foods are crossover foods. They're Jewish, they're Arab, you know, they're Christian at different points in history, and you see how they've sort of melded into all of our repertoire today.
But Jen, give us the premise of the book, and then we can expand from there, because it's not just that the diaspora has exposed. I mean, you go back in such detail. What about these tablets with the cuneiform?
Well, it's a book. I always tell people that it's a book for all of us, Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And it goes way, way back to before there was Christianity, before Judaism, before Islam, when people were deists. And it goes back to the 2500 BC and earlier, with four cuneiform tablets that were found in Babylonia and that are now at the Sterling Library at Yale.
Okay.
And
yes,
these tablets had 44 recipes on them.
Yeah.
And archaeologists told me to look at these recipes, which I did. And the recipes were for the gods. These were for feasts for the gods. But there was one that had borscht in it, which was pretty interesting, that beets were used back then. Another one had what I was interested in, was it like a big stew with an oryx in it, which was a cow, an extinct
an oryx?
Huge cow.
An oryx? The animal.
Oryx.
The man.
Yeah.
Okay.
And but I was interested in what were the ingredients. So you found chickpeas there. And then you also found sesame. Sesame, we know, came from China. Therefore, if there was sesame and there was chickpeas, there was a gruel called hummus. And we also know that 12,000 B.C., there was hummus in Jordan. I mean, excuse me, chickpeas. But if there were sesames, there was sesame oil, which is the oldest grain oil. And other oils came as a result. My guess is that you, like grape seed oil, would be a similar thing. You would take grapes and put them through between two stones. And the same that you did for olive oil and coconut oil.
Yeah, but I read that in your book about the grapes. And I thought that's exactly what they would have done. They would have gotten the oil out.
Now you've forgotten the one root that's interesting, which is that Mrs. Beaton, famous British lady chef, or cook,
right,
I guess you would call her, she had a recipe for oryx, and it says, first slaughter your oryx. So you didn't know that.
I didn't get that one.
You didn't know that's what she was cooking.
Yeah, but there's so much information in this. Like, rhubarb was originally used as a vegetable.
Right, yes. Right. And so that you find in old Greek and Turkish cookbooks a fish with a rhubarb sauce.
Uh-huh.
And and also shav, which is sorrel's cold soup, sometimes with cottage cheese, but that was originally in Lithuania, where they liked sour foods. They used it with rhubarb, and I make a rhubarb sorrel soup in this cold soup in the summer that a lot
really?
Of people's faces sort of pucker. It's in the book, but I really love it with all kinds of herbs in it. And
is it in this
sorrel
book?
What?
Is it in this book?
It's in that book, yeah.
I
also love rhubarb dessert, and especially right now, because the rhubarb is bright red right now. So it's much more flavorful than rhubarb that later in the season.
I just want to turn to the right page and make sure you left the leaves out.
Oh, yeah, right. You can't.
Yeah,
actually, it's funny you should say that. I was thinking yesterday, I wonder if that is like a Bibbermeister, if it's really true. But I'm not going to try it.
Yeah, right. I'm not sure either. I don't know how anybody would have figured that out without a few accidents, right?
Right.
People who have this idea that about Jewish food, which right. is really only a little bitty piece of the world of Jewish food, would be just amazed at this book, I think. I mean, it's mainly the Eastern European that people associate with Jewish food.
Well, I just think they're, you know, getting back to the early foods, you know, which I tried to show that we've been using things like chickpeas and chickpea flour and pomegranate paste and date jam for thousands of years, and as King Solomon said, nothing is new under the sun. We're rediscovering yeah. these exact same ingredients. There are three characteristics, I think, of Jewish food. One is the dietary laws, which right. Jews follow. The second is even if they don't follow them, in the back of their head, they know that you have to separate meat and milk, that you can't eat shellfish, you know, it goes on and on. But the other thing is Jews have always had an obsession about food, and probably partially because of the dietary laws that they had to be careful with what they ate, but I think that also because Jewish services are constantly having either food at the beginning or the end, mostly at the end. And so that they were looking in the then-known world, they were setting out, looking at different places for ingredients that would follow the dietary laws. And then the third characteristic, it seems to me, of Jewish food is that it's not like Italian or French food that is embedded in the land. It's really embedded in the laws. And because Jews were kicked out of so many countries, they had to adapt to so many other cuisines to where they lived. So, you know, you can find American Jewish food. You can find Russian Jewish food.
Oh, yeah.
It all depends on what's eating, you know, what you're eating there. And I was in El Salvador, a country that has 100 Jewish families. And they made all kinds of food for me when I was there. It was a gathering of some of those 100 families.
Oh,
and one woman made a yucca potato latke. I mean, a yucca latke with cilantro cream instead of potato latke. And that's exactly what this is all about. It's adaptation.
Yeah, Peter wouldn't like that, but he loves latkes. He's the master of the latke.
But I don't like yucca.
He can't stand yucca because he says it tastes like candle wax.
I think you'd like a yucca, or at least take the cilantro cream and make it, use your potato latke.
Yeah. Now, do you know Anissa Alou?
Who?
Anissa Alou. She's... originally Middle Eastern.
She's from Lebanon.
And she,
I know who she is.
Okay, well, anyhow, we just interviewed her about the food of the Islamic world, which also took her 5 years to write. And the two of you could compare notes and have a ball just talking about it.
Oh, wow. Is her book new?
Yes, it's brand out. Yeah, brand new. And it's gorgeous. And
who's the publisher?
Who published it? I can't remember.
I'll go look it up.
How the hell would I know?
Oh, I mean, it's Anissa Helou, and it's called right. Feast, FEAST.
Oh, great. I'll look at it.
Oh, you'll just, it's right up your alley. You just look
at it.
So, I feel.
Well, all she has to do is go to the website anyway.
No, yeah. I will. I'll get
yeah.
it.
Go to onthemenuradio.com, audio archive. Program date yesterday.
Oh, terrific!
And it's right. It's in yesterday. It's in
yesterday. Oh, the
program.
Interview is
in, it's in yesterday's
yeah.
program. Yeah.
Yeah, but she wants to see the book.
Well, the information about the book is
okay.
Is
I'll get it.
Well.
But you know, the exchange between the new world and the old world and back and forth and so forth always amazes me. And also the Far Eastern and Middle Eastern exchanges with Europe amazed me. I mean, who knew that all this was sort of happening? I mean, it was it wasn't like we could pinpoint it now because we're looking at it. But all this was happening, and every day there was a new development, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
it is quite fascinating.
Yeah, I just think it's amazing. But what else? I was amazed by what was it we were looking at, the Argentinian.
Oh, the empanadas.
The empanadas that you say came from.
I said out there from Argentina, and apparently you think they're not.
No. I mean, all those pocket pastries came with the Spanish here.
I bet the
And then they probably came from, I think they came from ancient Iraq. And you get chickpea, pocket pastries. They call them sambusak in Iraq, and they also call them that in the samosa, which comes from sambusak, in India. And a lot of Iraqis went to India with the Silk Road.
Yes,
and
you
then they
said
also, went to Spain when the Arabs came into Iraq from Saudi Arabia. So they brought them with them to Spain and then to the New World.
Now, my nephews who are from Cornwall in the southwest of England would say the Cornish
from pasties.
The Cornish invented it first, and they're called Cornish pasties.
Pasties.
Right, well, it's the same,
It's the same everywhere. Everybody has one.
But they were just, pocket pastries were, everybody was using them, especially poor people that went down to mines. They would bring a pocket pastry to eat.
Now, so that's Cornwall, yes.
Yeah, and then they brought them with them to the United States from Cornwall. Called them pasties. And then all the workers, like the Yugoslav workers and the Irish workers from Cornwall, people from Cornwall, they all went down to the mills, the iron ore people.
So many stories, wow. Nobody's ever explained to me also about what the word was for Spain, and which is why we get the Sephardic.
Right, Sephardic.
Yeah, I never knew about that at all. I don't know how I missed that one, but...
There are many different types of Jewish food, but there's Middle Eastern Jewish food, which is Yemenite, Ethiopian, Iraqi. Then there's Sephardic food, which means that it's touched Spain, and it's gone to other parts of the world. And then, of course, from Spain it's gone to Turkey, to Brazil, all over to Latin America, to Cuba, to the United States, to Montreal, to Venezuela, the island of Rhodes.
Oh, wow.
You find Sephardic food has gone that way. And then Ashkenazic food, which really began in northern France, went then to Germany, well, northern France and southern Germany, went east to Poland and Russia, and then to the United States, because 3/4 of the American Jews descended from Eastern Europe.
Yes. Now, there's so many things I learned in this book. The King Kashmir invited Jews to
come. Jews. And my husband is from a town... Oh, no, it's Smolensk, wait a minute, Zamoshki or something.
Yeah.
And it was this very beautiful town that was patterned after Siena in Poland. And this Count of Zamoshki, I think that's what it's called, invited Jews to settle there. But Kashmir also invited, I think that was his name, one of your listeners might correct me, invited Jews... during the Inquisition, I believe, to come to Poland at a point when they really needed a place to stay. And so they, many came from Spain and a lot of came from France, and other places.
Oh, it's just, as I said, packed. As I'm reading this book, Joan, I'm thinking to myself, how satisfied you must be that you managed to take all these little pieces and put them into a big picture. Really, I think it's such an accomplishment. You must be so proud of yourself.
Well, I am.
I see.
I mean, you know, I kept pushing my publisher to have a long introduction, and they thought, oh no, the book's so long anyway, we shouldn't do it. And I said, yes, it's important because it ties everything together.
It does. Oh, it's a wonderful book, Joan. I'm so glad we can talk to you about it, and I'm so glad that I'm going to be cooking from it, too.
Oh, good. Well, I hope everybody enjoys it, and they can always contact me at joannathan.com with any questions or whatever they're interested in.
Yes, the website, www.joannathan.com, right?
And I hope that I get to meet you sometime.
Oh, yeah. You're not going to Spain, are you, for the 50 Best?
Are you going?
Yeah.
When?
Leave next week.
Oh, no, I'm not going right now.
It's always good, you know.
All right.
But anyhow, I'm such good food, you know. So anyhow, it's Joan Nathan. And well, you have a title. You're not the queen of Jewish food. What was it?
King Solomon's Table.
No, I meant somebody refers to you as the queen of them.
The doyen of Jewish cooking.
Oh, doyen.
Or the Indiana Jones of Jewish cooking.
And the book is called King Solomon's Table, A Culinary Exploration of Jewish Cooking from Around the World. And listeners, you're going to thank us for referring you to this book.
So, well, thank you so much.
One more question, Joan. How did King Solomon deal with those thousands of wives and mistresses?
That's the question. But I think of him as the first foodie because he had all of these women bring foods from where they lived to Jerusalem. And so he got spices, and then he made sure that the 12 tribes of Israel were tithed with bringing foods to Jerusalem to him. And so that's what started people going around the world. They probably were going around the world anyway, but looking for spices and precious stones for King Solomon's temple.
Wonderful, wonderful.
We did tell you it was a great lady and a great book, didn't we?
Yes, say.
Anyway, don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Well, we knew we were on to something when we saw that this Cafe Spice company won not one but two Gold Sophie Awards in the Fancy Food Show, the Specialty Food Association's show. And then we knew even further once we tasted it, it was fresh, natural. And then we had a ball talking to the chef, Harry Nyack, who is totally professionally trained as a chef. He's cooked all kinds of things, French-based techniques and all kinds of other things. But he is a native from India, and he's in specifically, I believe he said South India, right?
Yes, that's where he's from.
Yeah.
He's cooking food. His cooking is pan-Indian, I think he would describe it as. He happens to be from the He's from the bottom left-hand corner.
Right.
And he used to be in the restaurant business, and instead of that, he decided that they would make meals to go. His first customer was Whole Foods Markets, and the rest is history, and why don't we let Harry tell his story?
Exactly. Well, we are very excited to talk to Chef Hari Nayak because we loved his food, and our grandchildren loved his food, and our son and daughter-in-law gobbled it up as well. It's like no wonder that you won 2 gold Sophies for the specialty foods. You know, you've been in the running frequently before, but this is capping it all with not one but 2 gold Sophies. Tell us the categories. One was appetizer.
That is correct. So it's very exciting to actually win it this year. The 2 categories. One is the best appetizer category. We won it for the potato samosa, and also the gluten-free category. We won it for the vegetable bhajia. So that is for this year. The last time, a couple of years back, we were second. We almost won for the soup category. So this is actually exciting to actually have the Sophie trophy in our office.
Well, you know, I mean, we've eaten in our lifetime a great deal of Indian food, especially in London, where there's quite good Indian restaurants.
Yes.
Your food is really right at the top with the best. But you are a trained chef, and you do something different from a lot of the prepared meal. First of all, when I say prepared meals, these have never been frozen, right?
No, they're not frozen. They're refrigerated meals that has a shelf life of 3 weeks. No preservatives, all natural. It just, you heat and eat, yes.
Well, I mean, the freshness is so startling if you look at a package and you think, oh, this is going to be like, you know, a long-term preserved everything, and it's not. It's very fresh.
Yeah, it's not. It's fresh meals. That's what makes it really flavorful. And it's not just that the way we prepare it. We make it in small batches. Even though our volumes are high, we prepare all our spice mixes and the spice blend in our spice room. Instead of buying pre-ground spices, we grind all our spices in-house, and it's handcrafted, and that's what makes it special and as close as you can get it in India or at home.
Well, I mean, it's really top quality.
Thank you.
Your company is called Cafe Spice. And when did that start?
Cafe Spice, now, coincidentally, we are celebrating our 20-year anniversary this year. So it is 20 years back, 1998. Yeah, that's when Cafe Spice was started as a restaurant brand, restaurant company. It still is a family-owned business. So it started as a restaurant company in New York City. It moved on to many other cities. Like, it started in New York City, went to D.C., Boston. And so moving into commissary was by default. It was not the intention was of creating a commissary was to support the restaurants. And then from that... Yeah, so to support the individual Cafe Spice restaurants, that's how it started 20 years back. And now we found a new niche market to get into retail, and our Whole Foods Market was the first client, customer of ours who wanted us to cook Indian food in New York City, and the rest is history. 20 years from now, we have a 50,000 square foot commissary in upstate New York. We no longer run any restaurants, but we are fully focused on creating restaurant quality meals for the retail market.
Now, are you yourself a chef?
Yes.
Well, no.
Yes,
I didn't know.
I went to the Culinary Institute of America.
Wow, there we go.
Yeah, in 96, I graduated in 97. But again, at the CIA, they don't teach you how to cook Indian food.
No.
I learned everything but Indian food at the school. But my training or my knowledge about Indian food is because I was born and brought up in India, and my I've worked with a lot of Indian chefs and home cooking. You know, just being Indian, you and a chef, a trained Western chef. I've first worked in many French restaurants in New York City, but ultimately my calling was comfort Indian food. That's what I'm doing right now.
So now, how large is your product inventory? I mean, in terms of number of different products.
In terms of Indian, we do not only Indian. We do we have a line of Thai products.
Really?
We have Indian products. Yes. So we have Thai curries too in retail. So Indian always remains the core. So we have approximately around 20 to 25 different products, not just in retail, but we have it in bulk for our food service customers. So overall, we do have more than 20, but in retail, we have about 7.
Uh-huh. And your selling points are, of course, that you don't use preservatives. So people who frequently have difficulty with Indian food have no worries about that. And you also have a very moderate spice level, don't you?
Yes, we have kept the spice. I mean, it is authentic recipes that that I've learned back in India. But the spice level, we have kept it to a point where it's not only if an Indian person takes it, they enjoy it, and if somebody new who has never tried Indian food also would enjoy it. So we have, I think, we have the right balance of spices and flavor. For me, is Indian food is all about flavor. So spice doesn't mean
exactly. Heat. Thank you.
Yeah. So that is a common misconception about Indian food, which we, well, through my books and through my classes, I keep trying to educate consumers that there is more to Indian food than just spice and curry. Indian food can be healthy, it can be really flavorful, and it's not at all spicy. It's all about flavor. And so I focus on that.
Well, it's true. I mean, at the restaurants that, I mean, here I know, and particularly, although some of the curry houses in London did the same, you get to order according to the level of spice, which misses the whole point, because the point is the flavor.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, that is exactly true. London is, I think, a few years ahead of North America in terms of the Indian cuisine and the availability of it, but not U.S. is fast, and it's growing really fast. Indian cuisine is growing really fast in the U.S. too, but it's not all about spice. The restaurants are doing better and better. 20 years back when I came to this country, the so-called curry houses were serving spicy vindaloos, and there were only few things that they were serving that people would assume that Indian food is all that. But we in India never cook in at home. It's complete home-cooked meals are completely different than what you would get in a restaurant.
Mm-hmm. I loved your, you're sort of right on trend with what you're cooking, too. I love the chickpea masala you had.
Yeah, it's a chana masala, yes. It's one of Indian staple.
Yeah, and on the I mean, there were a variety of the samples we had.
Did you try the cauliflower and potatoes, aloo gobi?
Yes, and I was talking to somebody on the phone, one of your publicists, and they kept telling me the cauliflower was not yours, and I said it certainly was.
Yeah, cauliflower and potatoes is probably the closest home-cooked meal, a home-cooked dish that you can get. It's at home. Indian home cooking is all about vegetables and stir-frying fresh cauliflower and okra and things like that. So this is a vegan dish. It's one of my favorites. It's very simple. We just recently launched it. So is our Bombay dal palak, which is yellow lentils with spinach. Right. The lentils are a huge staple in Indian cooking, and there is no meal without a lentil.
So I have lentils every morning at breakfast.
Lentils for breakfast?
Yeah, Peter makes it for me. I put whatever I have as a leftover, I put on my lentils. I mean, a lot of times it's soft-boiled eggs, but it also could be chicken, or could be anything. Pork, you know, whatever, but it's lentils.
For breakfast?
Yes.
That's in India, it's there's no meal without a side of lentils, so we eat there's no courses in Indian cooking. We don't eat our soup, salad, then main course. It all comes in a thali, which we call like a sort of a bento box, where everything, right from your vegetable or a lentil or your protein, whether it's chicken or chickpeas or paneer or cheese, anything, it's all with the rice and even the dessert. Everything comes all in one plate.
Right. Now, who did we just interviewed? Who was it that had all the bread recipes? What book was that? we just interviewed.
I'm lucky I can remember what day of the week it is.
Yeah, I know. But I noticed an increased interest in Indian cooking from the number of cookbooks we receive about Indian cooking. And one of them won a James Beard Award, Deepa's Secrets. Did you read that?
Oh, which one is that?
Deepa's Secrets.
Deepa's Secrets. Deepa. I have seen that. I have not read that, no.
She's the lady who transformed Indian recipes so they would be healthier for her husband.
Her husband was diabetic.
He was a major diabetic.
Okay. And major diabetic on insulin injections. And she took over when they moved to California. First of all, I did not know, she told us, that India is the diabetes capital of the world. And I never knew that. But at any rate. Go ahead.
No, it is. They eat a lot of sweets in India, and she could be very much right. Yeah.
Rice, yes. So, but she took the traditional dishes. And she told us, and she wrote it in this book, and she modified the dishes to reduce the starch and the and all the things that precipitate diabetes. And she fed this to her husband and nothing else. And she said that after a while, he didn't have to have his injections on a daily basis anymore. So, I mean, that's like a cure, right?
Yeah, I need to look at this book for sure.
Oh, please. It's, Deepest Secrets.
It is the ingredients. It's the, not only that, the Indian spices have healing benefits, especially we use a lot of turmeric in our recipes. Turmeric has a lot of health benefits. We call it the magic spice, the yellow spice, where when we used to fall sick as kids, even if it's a slight cough or a cold, your mother or your grandmother would stir a pinch of turmeric in warm milk and give it to you and your kids. I mean, we hated it, but that actually acted as your medicine.
Well, thanks to our friends at Whole Foods, we can actually get
the root, fresh root,
the original fresh root.
And if you think I'm strange enough by eating lentils for breakfast, I also daily have green tea with fresh turmeric root sliced in it and black pepper, ground black pepper.
This reminds me of my home growing up, which my grandmother used to force feed us that when we were sick. It's become a trend now, but in India, ancient the remedies were always big, and that's it's coming to the West as a new trend, which is exciting to see.
Oh, I mean, I think it works. Although
it works,
telling you,
definitely works.
There's a Mexican thing I'm doing now. It's the maguey cactus sap, and they tell me that I'm supposed to have a spoonful of that every morning. So I've been trying that to see if that does something miraculous to this body of mine.
Yeah, I'm sure it will.
So tell me what's next.
I have to send you copies of my cookbooks, too. I don't know if you have.
Nobody gave me any cookbooks. I didn't know you had cookbooks.
I have written about six. I'm on my seventh cookbook.
Most
of them are about Indian cooking, and I wish you had that before we spoke, but I will make sure that you have my cookbooks in a week so that you can have some exciting recipes. Mine is not diabetic or any of that sort. Mine is simple, how to cook simple Indian food at home without creating any, fuss. Going into your local supermarket and making Indian food simpler. That's my books. Most of my books are based on that.
And now, what part of India are you from?
I'm from the southern part. I'm southwest, right on the coast. Which is
Kerala?
3 hours 3 hours south of Goa and 3 hours north of Kerala. So I'm right in between Goa and Kerala.
I'm dying to go to Goa.
Is that what they call Kerala?
Kerala is most southernmost south state, and Goa is northwest. So I grew up in a small beach town right in between the two states.
Okay.
You know, another big hit with our grandchildren was the vegetable payas. What is it? They look like like meat patties, but they're vegetable.
Vegetable bhajia.
They love that.
Yeah, that is what won Sophie Award for a gluten-free appetizer.
Uh-huh.
So that is, it's gluten-free, it works. As a patty, you can make a slider with that. It's all vegetables. Just the binding is the chickpea flour. We call it besan. That's what holds it all together. It's gluten-free.
Now, are there any great Indian restaurants in the U.S.?
There are many. I think it's there are some in New York City. There are some in the San Francisco area. But I think there are a lot of regional Indian restaurants that have popped up, especially specializing in regional Indian. So Southern Indian, there are vegetarian restaurants in New York City that just specialize in those, that is a lentil crepe,
mm-hmm.
and vegetarian Indian. So Indian food is so diverse that, it's like saying European restaurant, but it's as big as that. There is French, there's Italian, there's Spanish. So this, like, India is such a big country.
Right.
The state has its own cuisine. So the cuisine that I grew up with, there are no restaurants in the U.S. based on that cuisine. There is no Goan restaurant. There is no Kerala restaurant. But in India, you specify, okay, I want to go to Kerala restaurant today where I'm going to just eat food from Kerala where the sauces are very tropical. It's more coconut milk based,
right.
Similar to Thai. It has a lot of similarities to Thai and Malaysian cooking because it's more tropical. We do not use cream in that region at all compared to the north. North, it's more heavier, cream based sauces, a little more spicier because it's colder up north. So it's completely diverse. And there have been a lot of regional restaurants that have been popping up in the U.S., which is very exciting to see that the Indian cuisine is getting more recognition and people traveled well and they know that Indian food is much more than just naan bread, mango lassi, and chicken tikka masala. There is more to that, which is nice to see, which is great to see that.
Yeah, we ate at one restaurant, Indian restaurant, where they had Indian wine in London.
Yes, Indian wines. Yes, there's a brand, a couple of brands that have been doing very well, and it's available here too.
It was quality wine. It was very good wine.
Yes, it is. Really, there is a region in India where the weather kind of is similar to California, so they grow grapes there, and it's pretty good wine, pretty decent wine, yeah.
Well, Chef, it's really been wonderful talking to you. And listeners, you could get this Cafe Spice is the company. And believe me, it's worth investigating because you get healthy, fresh Indian food that is no preservatives, all natural, and tasty as anything. And Chef Hari Nayak, thank you very much and congratulations on your 2 gold Sophies.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure talking to you both.
You too. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Next up, we have a book with a title and a half called Flavor Bombs. Who wouldn't want that? And if you listen to Adam Fleischman, you're going to understand how to get the most umami into your diet. I can't pin down Adam Fleischman exactly. I think he's not to be pinned down. He's a very expansive person. His book that we're going to be talking about is Flavor Bombs, the umami ingredients that make taste explode. But you do a whole bunch of other things. You have 2 chains of restaurants and about to branch into a third, right? Tell us about those.
Well, yeah, I started Umami Burger and 800 Degrees Pizza, and now I'm working on actually 4 new brands. One is an Italian brand, one is a coffee brand, and a Mexican brand, and we're also doing a vegetarian brand. And I have another brand called PBJ LA, which is in Grand Central Market in LA.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Another vegetarian brand. Yeah.
I love that market. Another thing, I mentioned to you beforehand when we were talking, we have a number of things in common that I read about in your book. One of them was you like Rancho Gordo and Steve Sando, who I adore. I mean, I love the beans. And what was the other one? Oh, yeah, the Rusticella, the Rusticella pasta is your choice for dried pasta.
Sure.
And we love those guys, and we've been in that plant. There's actually somebody supervising, even though they're automated machines, somebody actually, a human being, checks them coming off the pasta coming off of the machine.
Right, yeah. Rusticella has a rough Franz Dye style, so you can get more sauce clinging to the pasta because how rough it is and how non-uniform it is.
Right. Now, the other thing that surprised me was that you're a fan of Heston Blumenthal, who's a great friend of ours. And
great.
Oh, yeah. We love him. We didn't see him. We haven't seen him for about a year. Now, he wasn't in Melbourne last year for the 50 Best. No, he was in Melbourne, but we didn't see him. I can't remember why. But he's a genius, absolute genius.
Yeah, he really inspired me to look at recipes from new points of view and take things apart and kind of re-envision classic recipes. He was sort of the inspiration for that.
Did you work there or did you just visit?
What's that?
Did you stage?
Did you actually work at the Fat Duck?
No, I've never even met him before. It was just through his books.
Oh, really? You've never met him? Oh, he's a character.
I'm sure.
Well, he's changed a lot. I mean, yeah. When we first met him, he was really into theory, and he kind of burst out of that a little bit and got a little more social and partying. But we did an interview with him. We recorded it, and we were working out of the studio at the time. And we played the recording, but we had Harold McGee on the phone commenting on the interview as it went along.
Ah, sure. Harold McGee, yeah.
That was a killer, yeah.
Yeah, he's
okay,
great.
For those who have been living in a, I don't know where someone, explain umami and who the Japanese guy who first identified it and so on. Just give us a brief elevator speech.
Sure. So people had always recognized the four basic tastes as sweet, sour, salty, and bitter. And then in the early 20th century, the Japanese identified that was different from the other four. And it's comprised of glutamates or amino acids, which are the basis of the umami. So it's a real thing that, you know, people have studied since the 20th century.
So it's a genuine article. I mean, it's not something Harold McGee made up.
No, it's not theoretical. People think it's a theory, but it's really an actual thing. It's amino acids. And, you know, the guy who founded it went on to create, like, MSG, which is, you know, a version of umami that's, you know, sort of lab-made. And what we do is try and extract it from natural substances like mushrooms, tomatoes, miso, soy, Marmite, yeast, kombu, and things like that.
It's interesting in a way that it should have been developed in Japan, where a lot of the food, a lot of people would say the food is really quite bland.
Yeah, they use a lot of umami products, though, like dashi and soy. So those things were, it was discovered in Japan, but it was used prior to that. You know, the French, with the Escoffier, they were into veal stocks and reduced demi-glace, and those are that was their version of umami, and that predated Ikeda, the guy who discovered umami in Japan. So it's been around for hundreds of years.
Right. Now, since then, of course, they've discovered all kinds of other tastes besides bitter, sweet, sour, salt, and umami. What's the one that makes you pucker your mouth? What's
sour?
No. There's tingle. It's tingly.
Tingly.
Things that make your lips tingle or your tongue tingle. I forget which it is. That's viewed as a taste now.
Yeah, I haven't worked at that one, but I'm sure they're going to come up with some more.
I'm sure.
Over now, time.
Your book stands out for its graphic layout and design. Who did that?
That was a collaboration between me, the photographer, and the publisher, Harcourt.
But what look were you going for? It's very catchy.
Yeah. They did a nice job with the art direction and everything.
Oh, yeah.
The pages are black, which I hadn't really seen before. And it has a texture to some of the pages in the cover.
I didn't see the texture that it has. One of your signatures is this umami burger, and it really is a stunner, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we basically looked up the ingredients that had the most umami, and the ones that came up were Parmesan and tomatoes and mushrooms, so we kind of used those on the burger rather than just traditional toppings like lettuce and, you know, things like that.
I guess what we should do is just, for listeners, run through, you have a list of things that are umami. Why don't you just mention some of them?
Well, the things that are most high in umami are dried mushrooms and certain cheeses like Roquefort and Parmesan and things like kombu, which is sea kelp that they dry and you make dashi out of it. So we try and use all those things that are particularly delicious in our cooking.
You know, I have a dried Maine seaweed in my kitchen, and I was going to cook it up some the other day, and the kombu has changed colors. Is that bad?
No, it probably just got drier. I mean, you're going to cook it. You're going to put it in you're going to put it in water, or sometimes one trick I do is you take it and you dry it in the oven, and then you pulverize it in a spice grinder, and then you can use it that way.
Oh, that's a good idea.
So it doesn't have, it doesn't really have a sell-by date.
No.
No, because it's dried. I mean, anything dried you want to use, like, within a year, I would say. I wouldn't keep it out for 20 years.
Well, it's been more than a year since. I got a whole crate of it from some from this guy called the seaweed guy.
Oh, yeah. Well, you should start using it because it won't last forever.
Oh, well, it's been lasting. There's a lot of it. So it's fish sauce.
Sure.
So many cultures have variations on fish sauce. You use Red Boat. You like Red Boat.
I like Red Boat, but if I also like garum, which is the Italian version of fish sauce, and they make those now as well.
That was Roman, actually, wasn't it?
Yeah, Roman. So yeah. They still make a garum, which is essentially a fish sauce with different types of anchovies. But, yeah, I use them in a lot of different dishes to boost the flavors. And really, it just adds a special umami quality without making things taste fishy.
Uh-huh. But you cheat. You throw chocolate in there, and that's not umami.
Chocolate in where?
In your list of your umami pantry. Chocolate doesn't belong there.
Chocolate for me is an honorary umami ingredient because it has a satisfying kind of effect, sort of like umami does.
Yeah, it does that. Tell us about some of your other recipes. Oh, I have to tell you, of course, you know, Peter is English. And I cannot stand Marmite.
Yeah, I don't love Marmite or Vegemite on their own, but when you mix
Vegemite,
them into things,
we lived in Australia, and you know, I had enough of that too.
Yeah, it's better. It's better mixed into stuff than it is by itself for me, but it adds a nice flavor for that.
Oh well, you know, like in England, they just smear it on toast, and the same with the Vegemite in Australia.
Yes, true.
So you have to kind of like it.
You got to like it. And people grow up on it, so they like it. I did not grow up with it, but I use it very sparingly in dishes and, you know, in cooking and things like that.
Well, you know, I was surprised. I am mad for tomatoes, even if they're out of season and not really ripe. I just love them. And You say it's the umami in them, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it's better to concentrate the umami. So what I do is I dry them in the oven instead of using them raw. So we tend to cook our tomatoes.
Right. Well, I mean, you do that when they're really nasty. Where's this? I'm looking for this recipe. I thought it was very clever. You used Marcona almonds.
Sure.
With scordalia, which is a Greek garlic.
Sure.
And you use it on potatoes.
Yeah, Marcona almonds are really flavorful, so we tend to use those a lot when nuts are called for.
Can you select a couple of other sort of stellar umami recipes?
Sure. Well, I did it from the book.
Yeah.
Like, the one that's the sort of the umami burger, but deconstructed into a tartare, that's a very good one. Because it has all the elements.
I wasn't sure about that one.
It has all the elements of an umami burger, but done in a fancier way, like for a dinner party. So you can take that and you can really have fun with it. And just, it's a really delicious one. I really like that one.
Yeah, I want to try your quick cook Japanese style collards.
Yep.
I mean, collards need a lot of help, I think.
Yeah, they're great. And then the other recipe I really like is the one with the duck breast, and it has the frigola sarda, which is the Italian sort of pasta with stock.
Oh, I like that stock, too.
Yeah, and the stock has chicken stock or duck stock, but it also has fish sauce, soy sauce, sriracha, sherry vinegar, Parmesan Reggiano and foie gras, so you get all the umami from all those things.
And wow.
A little bit of seriously grated kitchen sink.
It's a very tasty one. I really like that one a lot.
Now, I had a question. You use truffles a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, I actually found, who is it, has a product called Truffle Zest, which was good. And there's this guy, what's his name?
Yeah, I use the Truffle Brothers stuff who are here in L.A.
Yeah, I mean, where did they get their truffles? I mean, most truffle products, I think, taste chemical. And I think a lot of it is chemical.
They don't use any chemicals at all. They don't use any chemicals whatsoever.
What's their sauce, Adam?
They farm them themselves in Italy. And they hunt them themselves.
Alba.
They cultivate or they hunt?
They hunt.
They hunt. Okay.
And they're not just in Alba. They're all over Italy. Like, they get the black ones from, like, southern Italy, like Molise and the southern type of states.
Yeah, well, we
went to Aquilania.
Aquilania, yeah.
And the reason they have them all year is because they're in season in the winter, and then they preserve and jar all the other ones from the winter for the rest of the year. So.
Right.
But now you can get them from Australia in the off season. That to me is, we've been to some of those. Some of them are fake. The Australian truffle growing things.
Sure.
But there are some authentic ones.
The ones from Western Australia are real.
They're good, yeah.
Yeah, there's some very good Australian ones, but the Truffle Brothers are my main source. I've been working with them for over 10 years, and stuff is always really great.
Wow. Okay, so I guess that, is there anything else we need to cover about the book or future plans for you or what?
No, I guess my future plans, I hope to write more books.
Oh, good. What are you going to write about?
Someone's got to hire me first, but...
They've got to hire you.
Whatever they want me to.
I see. So they approach you, the publisher approaches you?
Yeah, they approach me, and I need to get another book deal so I can keep writing and have a job.
Yeah, well, it's not that easy. I mean, people don't realize how much work it is writing these books, especially with recipes in them.
Yeah, so, a lot of work.
You are in L.A.?
Yes.
Yeah, we haven't been in L.A. for a long time. We need to come with all the food explosion there. I'm really enjoying this book, and I'm enjoying talking to you, Adam Fleischman. And listeners, absolutely get this Flavor Bombs book. You're going to love the umami ingredients in it and the flavors he pulls out of all these. And they're doable. The recipes are doable. Once you have your pantry involved, you're okay.
Yeah, they're all home-cooked recipes. They're all doable. Nothing is too complicated.
All right. Well, thank you very much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
Hope to see you sometime.
For sure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, sweetheart, I think it's time to go pack. Listeners, we'll be bringing you news from Spain in the next couple of weeks, I'm sure. And in the meantime, well, we hope that you won't be too jealous and that you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.